This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Donald Trump openly urging foreign governments to investigate his political foes, doubling down on action that is already the subject of an impeachment inquiry. VOA Steve Herman reports.
Answering questions from reporters on Thursday morning, Trump was asked what favor exactly he desired from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during a July 25th telephone call.
They should investigate the Bidens.
And he is also calling for China to conduct a similar investigation, alleging, without providing evidence, the former vice president and his son scammed the two countries. Trump faces an impeachment inquiry, which centers on a whistleblower complaint that the president abused his power by soliciting interference in next year's election from a foreign country, namely Ukraine. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
Meanwhile, as AP's Tim McGuire reports, the diplomat at the center of the Trump inquiry says that he warned Ukraine.
Former Special Envoy to Ukraine Kurt Volker met in private for hours Thursday with members of House committees involved in the impeachment inquiry of President Trump. California Democrat Eric Swalwell says they heard and saw a lot about the effort to get Ukraine's president to investigate Joe Biden and his son, Hunter.
We saw further evidence that there was a shadow shakedown going on.
North Carolina Republican Mark Meadows says Volker was asked the same question maybe 20 times about Trump making promises to Ukraine's president in exchange for dirt on the Bidens.
What we do know is there was definitely no quid pro quo.
Meadows also wants a transcript of Volker's interview made public. Tim McGuire, Washington.
And you can find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. At least 27 people have been killed and hundreds injured following anti-government protests this week in Iraq's capital, Baghdad, and other cities. VOA's Henry Ridgewell is following the story.
A few hundred protesters defied a government curfew Thursday on the streets of Baghdad as security forces fired tear gas and warning shots above the crowd.
Even with the curfew, I swear to God we will not retreat. We are demanding our simplest rights.
Those rights remain ill-defined, but the protests are rooted in Iraq's stuttering economy and weak government. Many demonstrators cite a lack of jobs and basic services. Iraqi forces declared victory over the Islamic State in 2017 after recapturing the city of Mosul from the terror group. 2 years on, there is frustration at the lack of progress. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
It's the next phase of negotiations between the U.S. and the Taliban to end the United States' longest-running war. Delegates from both parties are said to be resuming bilateral talks soon. That announcement was made by Pakistan's foreign minister, but so far, President Trump appears noncommittal. U.S. President Trump abruptly canceled the Afghan peace process on September 7th, citing continued Taliban attacks on civilian and American troops in Afghanistan. A Las Vegas law firm says there is an agreement on a settlement between MGM Resorts International and victims of the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. The legal firm said MGM has agreed to pay between $735 million and $800 million to victims of the 2017 shooting that killed 58 people and injured hundreds. The law firm, which represented 2,500 victim claims, said the final amount of the settlement with MGM depends on the number of claimants. The shooting 2 years ago this month took place at a Las Vegas country music festival at MGM's Mandalay Bay Resort. President Trump says that he is signing an executive order to beef up Medicare programs.
I'll provide Medicare Advantage plans with new tools and options, and it'll help Medicare beneficiaries gain faster access to the very latest and greatest medical devices and therapies. My order also pursues reductions in the unnecessary regulations that you don't need, you don't want to see, that never come into effect, and that cost a lot of money, enabling doctors and nurses to spend less time on paperwork and more time with their patients.
Mr. Trump made the announcement while meeting with seniors at the Villages in the state of Florida. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Cameroon's president drops charges against over 300 prisoners, but the separatists are not impressed.
This presidential decree passed today by Mr. Biya does not include those who have already been judged and condemned in their kangaroo court. People like Tassan Wilfred, Sisiko Ayokpebe.
The World Health Organization is concerned about the impact of ongoing doctor strike in Zimbabwe. Gambia's former vice president testifies before the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari visits South Africa in the wake of recent xenophobic attacks there.
If the two major powers in the African continent, especially the sub-Saharan continent, Nigeria and South Africa, work together, many of the challenges faced by the African continent could be resolved.
Rwandan authorities arraigned 25 alleged Rwanda National Congress Party combatants, and we'll speak with the spokesperson of the Sudanese Professionals Association. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are all coming up on Daybreak Africa. Cameroon President Paul Biya has dropped charges against 333 prisoners arrested for their alleged roles in the two-year-long uprising in the country's English-speaking regions. Mr. Biya's announcement, made on Twitter on Thursday, comes as the national dialogue launched this Monday to seek solutions to the conflict continues. Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Ambazonia Separatist Republic. He says President Biya must release all English-speaking Cameroonians held since 2016, including 10 separatist leaders who were sentenced to life in prison in August.
You cannot release 323 people out of 5,000 and counting who are in prisons all over their country. Secondly, if he releases 333 people, what is he going to do with those his soldiers have killed? What about the villages and towns which have been burnt down? Does he want us to go celebrating because he is releasing 333 people? They were not supposed to be in jail in the first place because none of those arrested was arrested with an arrest warrant. They all ought to be free, including my mother and my sister.
You said they were not supposed to be in jail, but the government can argue, Chris, that the country is involved in a war with your organization.
Yes, the country is involved in a war. They declared the war. We did not declare war. And even so, the law also entails that when you want to arrest somebody, you need an arrest warrant. For all those in jail, none of them, my mother did not receive an arrest warrant, neither my sister. How about our leaders who were abducted in Nigeria? These are all people that need to be released because their detention is illegal. Now, James, let me add one more thing here. This presidential decree passed today by Mr. Biya does not include those who have already been judged and condemned in their kangaroo court, which means people like Tassan Wilfred, Sisiko Ayokpebe, they will not benefit from this decree. So what kind of amnesty is that?
As you know, it takes two to tango. The president, President Paul Biya, this week began the national dialogue. And so with the release of these 333, one would say the president continues to make concessions to you.
That is not enough. This is the problem. There are only two parties in this conflict: the Southern Cameroon's Ambazonia and French Cameroon. When you call for a dialogue and bring people from every part of the country and you call it national dialogue, whereas you know the war is between your regime and the other part of the country, and then the Southern Cameroonians you bring there, you deny them what they are asking. What do you call that? Do you call that a national dialogue when you cannot listen to the party and you cannot even address the root causes?
So is it safe to say now that the Ambazonia people will not accept anything from the Cameroonian government except independence?
We will not accept anything from Biya's regime. What we want is a complete independence, a free Ambazonia. And let me also add, we are going to get as minimal arms as we can. Mr. Biya is not ready to dialogue with Ambazonians. And we are asking every Ambazonian, this is time to arm the restoration forces to the teeth. Give them the power they need, the firepower they need to confront the French Cameroon army.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Ambazonia Republic of Cameroon. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has apologized for recent xenophobic attacks as Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari begins a three-day state visit to South Africa. At a meeting to discuss relations between the two African economic giants, the South African leader says his country is committed to the ideals of African unity and solidarity to respect the human rights of others. The visit follows a recent outbreak of violence targeting African nationals. VOA's Peter Clotte spoke with Dr. Somadoda Fikini, an independent policy and political analyst, about President Buhari's three-day visit to South Africa.
From the media and the public, the reception seemed to be very positive because there is a general understanding that if the two major powers in the African continent, especially the sub-Saharan continent, Nigeria and South Africa, work together, many of the challenges faced by the African continent could be resolved. And as such, they could have a mutually beneficial relationship, which could lead to greater integration of the continent and economic development.
Why do you think there hasn't been a working relationship between Pretoria and Abuja, particularly looking at how strong these two countries' economies are?
I do think that it is largely because of the leadership crisis these countries have experienced in the past and instability. Because at the time when there was good chemistry between the former president Thabo Mbeki and Obasanjo, these two countries literally were working very well and they were giving direction to the African continent. So the personal chemistry of leaders who also have convergence of vision of driving the continent, understanding that regional powers working together can actually have an influence, is what has worked very well. But these countries recently have been too preoccupied with their own internal political challenges, especially from the ruling parties and election campaigns, and they took their eyes off this very important relationship.
The two presidents meet at a time when there was a recent surge in xenophobic violence. How do you think these two leaders can address this concern?
Well, there is nothing which could surpass what they've committed to. One, opening up their trade relations and reinforcing that in a mutually beneficial manner, but also having a joint crime-fighting exercise where crime intelligence in each one of these countries could help identify. Because very often, whilst you have a majority of Nigerians in South Africa who are well-mannered, who are in good positions in business, some professors in universities, doctors in hospitals, you may have the tiny minority involved in drugs, human trafficking, and the blemish now tend to spread into people who are not involved in these. But if there was a commitment beyond the political grandstanding between these two leaders and governments to say, let's work together to resolve these issues, it will go a long way to give a good signal.
What do you see as the anticipated relations between the two countries after this visit?
Well, I do think that if the leaders live up to the promise they made and they are consistent and there is government-to-government relationship and that follows into business investments, then you are likely to see countries which appreciate the mutual relationship that is mutually reinforced.
Dr. Somadoda Fikini is an independent policy and political analyst. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the South African capital, Pretoria. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington today. It's Friday, October 4th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The World Health Organization says it is concerned about the ongoing doctor strike in Zimbabwe, which has paralyzed the public health sector and left thousands of people without access to basic medical care. WHO country director Dr. Alex Gasasiri has appealed for dialogue between the striking doctors and government, saying some vulnerable people are being turned away at state hospitals.
We are very hopeful that proper dialogue between the doctors, the government, the employers can happen. We have been informed that the government, using their own resources as well as with through partnerships with other countries, are trying to address the issues of working conditions, rehabilitating facilities that the doctors can have what they need to work with and provide the services for the people. So we in WHO are really hopeful that this dialogue can happen. We understand that the issues around the economy, the issues around remuneration will also need maybe the interventions of other sectors beyond the health sector, beyond the Ministry of Health and Childcare. And some reasonable consensus can be achieved so that doctors can get back to work and provide the much-needed services for the population.
Yes, so what are your concerns around the impact of the strikes on patients? We hear that many patients are being turned away, some of them with very serious conditions.
So we are concerned that the most vulnerable people who are in most need of services would not be able to access the services that they would require if the doctors keep away from work. So that is a big concern for us. That is why we would hope that this could be resolved and they return to work soonest.
What role does the WHO play in a situation such as what is happening in Zimbabwe?
WHO, as you know, works with governments, works with partners to bring evidence, to bring the best practices from different places to strengthen the health systems of countries. One of the recommendations that WHO makes to countries in these situations, for the key actors to engage in dialogue.
Dr. Alex Gasasira is the Zimbabwe Country Director for the WHO. He spoke from Harare with Gip Dube of View Zimbabwe Service. Gambia's former Vice President and Women's Affairs Minister, Asai Tu Njai Sidi, on Thursday admitted before the country's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission that she had served a murderous regime which has no respect for human rights and press freedom. She also admitted that while serving Yahya Jammeh's regime, 14 students were killed in April 2000 by Gambia's security forces during a protest march. Pandero Mbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The former Vice President, Aishatu Njai Sidi, began her Thursday testimony at the TRRC with a defensive position. She has repeatedly denied knowledge about knowing what had transpired on April 10, 2000, when 14 Gambian students were massacred, including journalist Pa Omar Barrow. She claimed that during Jammeh's rule, government workers were banned from reading private newspapers. But lead counsel S. Al-Fal wasn't convinced.
Isn't it odd that as vice president, you only learned about student casualties 2-3 days after the fact?
It's possible 2 days after or three.
Mm-hmm. Where were you?
I was in my office.
The whole country knew that students were killed.
They knew, I didn't know.
And the vice president of the country, with responsibility over all the forces in the country, did not know that students were killed.
I was busy with these meetings.
The murdered and injured students were taken to the country's main Edward Francis Small Teaching Hospital, which is located just outside the vice president's office.
State House was just right next to the National Hospital.
Yes, I went
casualties
to the
were being brought in all the time.
I didn't see.
The sirens were going.
I didn't know.
And yet still you didn't know.
No, and I'm not going to say here that I know when I didn't.
Isn't this another case of selective amnesia?
No, it's not selective.
Dictator Jammeh was not in town at the time of the students' unrest. He was on an official trip in Cuba. One of the witnesses told the commission that he was with Jammeh in Cuba when the former despot had spoken to his vice president. He says Jammeh had given orders for the protesting students to be mercilessly dealt with. VP Njai Sidi says she was misled by the security chiefs who told her that there were armed students among the protesters. She later found out that the students weren't armed.
A coroner's inquest was done and they have proven that indeed the shooting was done by the security.
But didn't you see that you have participated in grossly misleading the Gambian population?
Without unknowingly, yes.
She has appealed to the victims of Dictator Jammeh's rule.
I mean, well, killing of any child definitely is unforgivable. If it is deliberate, it's unforgivable. And I said, therefore, those who lost their children, we apologize to them.
The TRRC has taken a recess break on its public sittings until October 14. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pan Derimbai reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Four Burundian and three Ugandan nationals are part of a group of 25 alleged Rwanda National Congress Party combatants who were arraigned on Thursday in a military court in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. They were arrested in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. The Rwanda National Congress Party has denied the 25 are members of the RNC. Yuji Uwimana has details from Kigali.
Today's hearing was the second in 2 days. All 25 suspects are charged with forming and being part of an irregular armed group, conspiracy against an established government, and maintaining relations with a foreign government to destabilize Rwanda. Some pleaded guilty yesterday to some charges, but today they requested an adjournment to get lawyers. The case was suspended to October 14th. The prosecution says the defendants are part of P5, an outfit created from a merger of anti-Rwanda forces that reportedly includes Rwanda National Congress RNC of General Kayumba Nyamwasa. He is the former Rwanda's chief of defense staff, who is in exile in South Africa. Jean-Paul Turchimier, the spokesperson of RNC, told VOA the defendants don't work for his party. He says, "We are all wondering where they got them from, how they brought them. It is a lie to say that they are our combatants. That tag has been fabricated by the government." The suspects also include one Malawian. All were captured in combat in the DR Congo during an operation by Congolese forces against foreign fighters operating in the country. Rwanda DRC joint operations to eradicate such forces are the result of recent bilateral talks and the current good bilateral relations. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
This week, Sudan's ruling Sovereign Council and the cabinet adopted the amended transitional constitutional document. Last week, Sudan signed an agreement to open a human rights office at the United Nations, the latest achievement in the country's march towards democratization following the overthrow of former President Omar al-Bashir. Dr. Mohamed Nagy al-Assam has served in a pivotal role as spokesperson for the Sudanese Professionals Association that spearheaded the coalition that led the revolution against former President Bashir.
The office of the High Commission of Human Rights in Sudan was something Sudanese people have been eager throughout the rule of al-Bashir regime, and it's also one of the major demands of the armed rebel movement, also throughout the dialogues and the peace negotiation itself. So now in Sudan we have freedoms, we have rights, and we are gaining more and more freedoms by each day going by. Things have changed a lot in Sudan after al-Bashir regime fell. So we want to keep these freedoms and these rights. We want to ensure that every Sudanese citizen, especially in the conflict areas, are enjoying their freedoms and enjoying their rights. And the Office of Human Rights will help a lot in ensuring that and in watching the situation of human rights in Sudan and in reporting as well any sort of human rights violation that could happen throughout the transitional period and beyond.
Let's move to the constitution document. I know it went through a lot of challenge and you guys end up having two copies.
Yeah, it's not totally true that we have two copies of the constitutional declaration. Yeah, we have like the constitutional declaration, which was modified by the agreement of the two sides, the TMC and the FFC. And it was rewritten itself, like punctuation issues and issues like that. So the modified copy of the constitutional declaration is now the one that we are binding to, and the one that we think is the right copy of the Constitution. The Sovereign Council itself was formed depending on the modified copy of the Constitutional Declaration, which is now the ruling paper and the law of the Sudan. It should be published very soon to the media and through the official newspaper, the Gazeta, as the law said, to finally be seen by every Sudanese citizen.
I want to talk about al-Bashir started. What is going to happen to him? Is he going to take him to ICC?
Al-Bashir now is tried in issues of corruption absolutely, these are not the only issues or the only violations that al-Bashir has made. He has made much more huge atrocities against the Sudanese citizens, like Darfur genocide and the wars in Blue Nile and Nuba Mountains, and the torture and killing of hundreds of thousands of Sudanese people. All of these issues should be raised, and al-Bashir should be tried against them, plus all the other members of NCP and whoever has participated somehow in violating the Sudanese rights and freedoms.
That was Dr. Mohamed Al-Assam, a spokesperson for the Sudanese Professionals Association. He was speaking with viewers Nadia Taha in our Washington studio. Time now for Daybreak Africa's Post. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Doha, Qatar, where it is day 8 at the 2019 IWAF Athletics World Championships. Later today, Ghana's men and women relay teams have a mountain to climb in their quest to qualify for the 4x100m final. The teams have been handed tough opponents in the semifinals and must produce their best to qualify for Saturday's final. The men's team will come up against defending champions Great Britain, favorites USA and Jamaica, with Brazil, Turkey, Germany and host Qatar completing the semifinals list, while the women's team have been paired against Jamaica, Great Britain, Germany, China, Italy, Brazil and West African rivals Nigeria in the semis. The teams must finish in the first four with a good time to stand any chance of progressing to the finals. Ghana athletics coach is Leo Miles Mills.
Things are going quite well. The guys are all healthy and excited and are ready to compete, and hopefully we can advance and be in the finals on Saturday.
In the shot put men's event, African Games champion Chukwuebuka Enekwachi made history on Thursday as he became the first Nigerian ever to qualify for the final of the shot put men's event after his second round throw of 20.94m automatically booked him a place in the final. Shortly after his qualification, he said he felt comfortable with his body compared to his performance during the 2017 London Championships.
I've had a long season, so the downside of it is, you know, I'm a little bit exhausted and things like that, but at the same time, I'm learning some tricks. You know, I'm learning how to deal with different factors. I'm learning how to throw in 115 degrees and humid and being exhausted and all that stuff, but at the same time, I think I'm way more comfortable as a competitor than last year and the year before, so it's a steady progression up.
And staying with the World Championships, Kenya's 2017 London World Silver medalist Timothy Cheruiyot and Rogers Kwemoi made it to the 1,500-meter semifinals in the Doha World Championships on Thursday. Cheruiyot won in 3 minutes, 36.82 seconds to make it through to Friday's semifinals, while Kwemoi sneaked through as one of the fastest six losers after finishing seventh in heat three. And now to football news, and on a sad note, former Nigerian under-17 Golden Eagles captain Isaac Promise is dead. His club, American side Austin Bold, said that the 31-year-old passed away on Wednesday night but offered no explanation as to the cause of his death. Isaac Promise was part of the Nigerian side that won a silver medal at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. He spent much of his career in Turkey with Trabzonspor. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that is it for this Friday, October 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, saying have a lovely weekend.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.